Hey there, it's Ryan with Season 2 of 50 States of Mind. Before the episode starts, if you can take just a second and leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts with something you learned from one of our episodes, it will help us continue with our mission of helping people start a dialogue here in America and overcome our preconceived notions about different parts of the country. Because we all know that one of the keys to bringing us all together is to talk a little less and listen a little more. Are you ready? Let's go. Okay, we continue with the 50 States of Mind quarantine series, and today we have a very, very special guest calling in. What's your name and where are you calling from?
Hi, Ryan. My name is Madeline Weinstein, and I am calling in from New York City.
New York City, the current epicenter of the coronavirus.
Oh, yep.
How are you doing?
I'm okay. It's weird because, like, right now I'm sitting in my bedroom and I have this kind of sweet but also urban New York City view from my window, like with some trees, but then just a bunch of, you know, 3-story kind of dingy brick buildings. So I feel kind of secluded, but I just like hear faint sirens pretty much constantly. So it's this just like kind of weird, eerie experience of like knowing there's so much chaos and panic and awful things happening in this city, but feeling so mainly separate from it.
You're a lifelong New Yorker, right?
Yeah.
So is this the craziest thing you've ever seen happening in New York City?
Yes. I think I was just journaling about this a little bit last night. I was thinking about like moments you live through that, you know, 20 years later, your kids are talking to you or like, oh my God, like what was that like to live through it? And right. And like some of those moments you don't know at the time are kind of crazy or impactful moments of history. And some like, you know, and right now this is very much a moment when like, we all know this is a big deal. So sometimes I feel the weight of that. And sometimes I don't really in my day-to-day life, you know, I'm also in Brooklyn. So it's not like I'm in some crazy packed central location in Manhattan. I don't really remember 9/11 that much. I was in fourth grade, maybe. And I have very, you know, a couple very specific, like, visual memories, like sense memories from then, but very few. So I think that of my like real conscious memory, this is probably like feels like the biggest thing.
I remember the moment that I knew it was serious, and that's when Broadway closed. You know, the show must go on. And when the show doesn't go on, people realize that the magnitude is bigger than we expected. So how do you think this is going to affect actors in the present? And do you think it's going to change theater in the next year, 2 years, the way we interact with it?
I have no idea. Like, I think that's the thing. Like, I have no idea what the fallout of this is going to be. You know, it's funny. The day all the theaters closed, I had a comp to see a show my friend, an off-Broadway show my friend was in. And I was seeing it with my friend Jess. And that day he texted being like, Maddie, I'm kind of freaked out. Maybe we shouldn't go tonight. And this sounds so crazy and like kind of irresponsible of me, but my first thought was like, I wonder if he just doesn't really want to see it and is trying to get out of it. And that was the day. Then I texted my friend Tess and was like, hey Tess, you know, and this was true. I was like, you know, I have this little cough tickle and I think it's just allergies, but you know, just to be safe, I don't feel like I should go be in a theater. And then she texted me back 2 hours later being like, I actually think we're closing tonight.
Wow.
Yeah. But that, you know, the fact that when he texted me that my response was a little skeptical, like shows you how quickly this moved. Cause then like 3 days later, it would be unthinkable to be sitting in like with a huge group of people. I mean, that's the thing about theater. I think even slower than, you know, film or TV, you know, even after this is, you know, quote unquote over, whatever over really means, people, I don't think are going to be wanting to sit with a lot of people sharing their air. I don't know. I'm doing a TV show right now that just was, we were just put on pause, you know, theoretically for 2 months and then it's going to start up again. But also I'm like, when do you think this is going to be made? Mm-hmm. I know we have to carry on as normal and plan things, but it all just feels, I don't know, kind of weird and intangible, all of that stuff right now. But just the thing about film and TV, right, is you have the cast and the crew, you have the people on sets. So you do have people working really closely together. In that way, it's not a great place to be when there's some kind of infectious disease. But, you know, you don't have an audience. Everyone who's going, you know, is part of the production, is signed up to be doing this thing together. It's, you know, is employed.
Yeah, I almost wonder if like film production will become, stay with me here, kind of like porn, where like all the crew will be in hazmat suits and all the actors have to be tested in order to like be in a scene together. Is that the future? I don't know.
You know what? I was actually thinking about the other day. I was like, I was thinking, imagine this like crazy sci-fi universe where they have actors tested to see if they have the antibodies. And like, that's a pre-screen to like audition for something. I mean, already when you do like a big movie or TV show, I only had to do this once, but you go to get a physical.
Which movie was that for?
For Alex Strangel, the Netflix movie I did. But it's a really common thing, right? So if you're about to like star in a, you know, a TV show or something, I think this is, I know people do, I don't know if everything does this, but yeah, you go get a physical to make sure you're healthy, that you can do it.
Were you doing stunts in Alex Strangelove? I don't really remember any.
No. But it's just for like, they ask you if you have cold sores.
Oh, really?
Like if you're going to be kissing people?
Yeah.
Yeah. Is that crazy? I mean, not like they wouldn't let you do it. It's not like The Bachelor. I don't know if you knew that right. Little tidbit about The Bachelor. But
Wait. I don't know that tidbit about The Bachelor.
Oh, yeah. If you have any kind of STI, including oral herpes, you can't be on The Bachelor.
Really?
Yes.
I mean, as someone who's auditioned for The Bachelor and not had oral herpes, like,
Did I help you make your Bachelor audition tape?
I think we talked about it, that I was going to run around New York dressed as Dumbledore.
Yes.
Yeah, I'm not sure I'd be a great candidate, but I did go when it was our senior year at Northwestern. I went down to some ballroom downtown Chicago and they were like, are you ready to get married? I was like,
oh, I
yes,
forgot.
My parents got married young and I want a love story like theirs. And
I mean, that's the line.
Yeah, maybe they're like, we've heard this before.
It's so funny. The show, like, it's really like if your parents got divorced, like it's like you almost have some real like injury. You know what I mean? Like you're a slightly bruised fruit if your parents got divorced on that show.
I wonder if that's how they talk about people. It's like, she's got herpes, parents divorced, bruised fruit. cut.
Oh God.
Well, as someone who's like gone through the entire Netflix catalog, highly recommend Alex Strangelove.
Yeah, I don't mind.
Girlfriend of a gay boy. Is that
my type?
How many times has that happened to you?
Okay. Alex Strangelove, Beach Rats. Which I think you can watch on Hulu.
Beach Rats is also amazing. If it's on Hulu, go watch it. It's very atmospheric. Violence alert. No, I don't want to say that. That's a spoiler. Never mind. Sorry. Keep talking about it.
No, it's true. Alex Strangelove and, I mean, it's not really a spoiler for either movie, I don't think. And Beach Rats are like the most different movies you could get tonally. Like one's a teen, like a really heartful, you know, fun teen rom-com on Netflix, and the other one is super dark. I don't know even what this means, but like kind of like Euro feeling, whatever you think that means, like shot on film. But in both of them, I play the girlfriend of a closeted gay, or at least not straight gentleman. Yeah. And in college, oh my God, Ryan, did I ever play your, no.
I was never so lucky.
No, I was in an adaptation of Giovanni's Room by James Baldwin, playing the fiance of a gay man. Second Breath, a student-written show, freshman year. Yeah, it's a theme in my short but illustrious career.
I guess now that we're talking about how, you know, live theater may be doomed, it's a perfect time to move into what your state is. So I know you've waited and you've wondered what state we'll be talking about today. So I want to know, Maddie, what you know about the state of Indiana.
Oof, I know very little about the state of Indiana. I know it's in the Midwest, right?
Bingo.
Okay, I do know it's in the Midwest. Okay, can we have a period instead of a question mark at the end of that? It's in the Midwest. I'm just terrible at geography. No, I really don't have much of a sense beyond my kind of like general sense of the Midwest. You know, like I think I kind of my impression of like certain states like Michigan, I have some sense of like industrial history of Michigan. We both went to school in Chicago. So obviously I have some sense of, you know, Chicago's its own thing. I've spent a little bit of time in Wisconsin, but Indiana for me just feels kind of like vaguely Midwestern.
Can you think of someone who was in the public eye recently who would talk non-frickin' stop about Indiana?
Oh my God, Pete. Oh God, the second you said that, I literally just like a figure and like a popped up like a hologram of him just like before me, like a Star Wars hologram, just like with a mic talking about South Bend. Before the New Hampshire primary, I was canvassing for Bernie. And I remember seeing this group of like probably high school students or just out of high school kids, maybe college kids, holding signs at this little roundabout for Buttigieg. And this like wave of fury came up in me. Like I wanted to hurt them. Like I feel when I'm playing a board game, like, right, we're talking about like when I'm playing like Settlers of Catan and someone like steals a resource from me and just like, it's fair play. And immediately this like rage bubbles up in me and I want to hurt them because I'm very competitive with board games. But it was incredible how visceral it was. And I like actively disliked those people in that moment, even though they're also, you know, younger than me, but like young people who are Democrats, who are passionate about politics. And if I saw Pete in a just a slightly different light, the way they see him, I'd probably feel the same way about, you know, like we have so much more in common. And just the way that it was almost like this movie in my head, right, where I'm the protagonist and they're the antagonist. So like, even when we're talking about Pete and this narrative that we both have about him, that it's funny, right? It's almost exactly the same narrative. Like that's one version of the movie where he's this kind of like cold, calculating, you know, cynical political figure. But that's like a narrative that we've created. And even the ways at times, like I found myself being turned off to Warren, who I think is wonderful and was like, was my, you know, number one candidate at one point earlier on. But then once I moved over more towards Sanders, it's like just because she was in opposition to him, I found myself like my feelings about her really changing. And I just am like so wary of all of the narratives we create. They're just always going to be wrong and they're always more complicated.
That is exactly the kind of stuff that this podcast, I think, is all about. This is what's going to heal, I think, our politics. If we start to realize we all have our own narratives, but other people have narratives too, and they're not doing it to make you mad. They're doing it because they feel a certain way based on their life experiences. And I think remembering what you just said is that's what's going to like get us together and realize people come to conclusions based on their life experiences that are different from you. And it doesn't make them, most of the time, doesn't make them bad people. And I think that's a cool mental exercise. I hear assertions like you just said that are really thoughtful and incisive about people, more from people that have been in the arts and have been able to step into other people's shoes. And I think it's a really important skill that I think a lot of people, when they hear about theater, think they're just doing another production of Anything Goes and waving around life preservers. But I think it's a little more than that.
Yeah.
So I guess a seamless transition into arts in Indiana. One of my favorite places I visited on my entire trip was a place called the Harrison Center for the Arts. The woman that founded it, Joanna, came to Indiana, married her husband. She's originally from DC. And she said, all right, I want to help cultivate the art scene here in Indiana. And she didn't want any more artists who were local Indianapolis artists to leave to New York or LA or I don't know, wherever artists go. So she created this foundation called the Harrison Center for the Arts, art studios, but it was in a neighborhood that she noticed was getting gentrified. So she talks a little bit here about the steps she made to make it a neighborhood arts community, to bring people in, tell the story of the neighborhood, get people involved, and ultimately prevent gentrification from changing the neighborhood. She knew that she was a new addition in the neighborhood, but she wanted to be a part of it and not necessarily just come in and ignore the past. So we're going to hear a little bit from Joanna about the steps she's taken in starting the Harrison Foundation, a charter school, and multiple other neighborhood initiatives using the arts to build community.
So you're at the Harrison Center, and we are home to 36 artists that have studios, and we're going to walk around the building, and you'll see that they're in every nook and cranny. And then we have five galleries that change art monthly. So you're in one of our galleries. This is called the City Gallery, and it's different from any other gallery at the Harrison Center. In the City Gallery, we only show place-based art. That's art that celebrates place and tells stories of place. We are a community development corporation, or maybe cultural development corporation. We look into the community, we see a need, and we come up with a distinctly cultural solution. So, for instance, we started a high school. And so across the street, there are 1,000 kids that around the corner that are learning to become art patrons.
I think the amazing thing about Indianapolis is that I could never have accomplished the things I've accomplished in D.C. here. So, I mean, what I did here, I could not have done in D.C. So there's no way I could have started a school. There's no way I could have acquired a few other buildings to do other community things or start the art center. We're working on a social impact incubator right now about a mile east of here pairing entrepreneurs and artists together in the same building to think about neighborhoods and to come up with creative solutions for bringing neighbors together. So the kinds of projects I've been involved in, just there's no way I would have been able to do there. And to that, so I live four blocks from here in a big Victorian house. And when I moved into my house, I noticed I had a front porch, but one of the first things we did was we built a back deck and put up a privacy fence, because that's what we did in suburban DC where I was from. And I lived in the house for at least 10 years before I actually understood the porch was more than decoration. And now, since 2007, I porch every single Sunday from 3 to 5:30. I sit on my porch with my neighbors, and we have all these traditions that we do now because we've been doing it so long. And that's also something that didn't happen in DC when I lived there. We had great neighbors, but it was definitely more of a backyard kind of neighborhood. And so I love that Indianapolis has brought me opportunity. It's brought me access, but it also is kind of has the amenities of a city, but it feels like a small town. And I think in our hearts, we all want to live in a small town. At their hearts, all neighbors want to be known and loved. And it's no different in Heron Morton than in the Hillside neighborhood. And so when we bring them together, I think there's a better understanding that we're all the same, that we all have the same desires. And that when you move into a neighborhood and you ignore the history, or when you try to erase the history, how hurtful that is, as opposed to knowing and loving that story and choosing to be a part of that story. And so the work that we're doing in neighborhoods is elevating neighborhood story, elevating long-term residents, and inviting new residents into an existing story and building community that way. And we're doing that all through the arts.
Okay, so that was Joanna at the Harrison Center for the Arts. Maddie, any thoughts?
Yeah, I thought she was amazing. I was really moved specifically by the way she said that all neighbors want to be loved and known. I thought that was so beautiful. And it was so kind of sincere and offhanded the way she said it. But I thought that was just so beautiful. And the way she was, you know, trying to take like really concrete action based on that and to live in that area in line with her values, you know, instead of just having some kind of like liberal awareness, but being like, oh, well, I live here now. Nothing I can really do about it.
And I love the idea of these porch parties that she has, where instead of going in your backyard with like an exclusive group of people you've invited, it's all neighbors. Come sit on my porch, sit around and chat for 2 hours every Sunday. And I think a lot of what's missing in the US right now is people feeling like they're accountable, that someone cares about them and wants to know them. I think we feel really divided right now because of politics, because of, I don't know, social media. There are a million reasons. But it's nice that people can use something that started with the arts and actually use that spirit to start to sew us all back together again.
Yeah, I thought she was really inspiring, and it did make me think, yeah, like, oh God, why don't we just all move?
I mean, it does bring up an interesting question. We all know that, you know, I moved to Kansas City, used to live in New York. It's a lot more complicated to just up and move than it sounds. And, you know, I listen to people like that on the trip and I'm just like, yeah, I do want to live in a small town, but it's not always realistic and easy. But I wonder, do you think things like coronavirus are going to change the way people think about where they live?
Well, it's funny. I didn't read the article, but I saw the title of a New York Times article the other day that was like, you know, urban density is what's hurting us in this crisis, but urban density is also what's helped us in other ones or something. But I think we tend to have pretty short memories when it comes to like really changing the way we live our lives. I think it takes a lot to really do that.
Yeah, I'm really kind of stuck on it, because one thing that she talked about was she's from DC, and she said she would not have been able to accomplish the sort of breadth of things she accomplished in the Harrison Center in Indianapolis, because there's so many people that are trying to do similar things that you sort of make a slightly smaller impact in a crowded room. But she said in Indianapolis, she was able to make a bigger impact. And I think one of the major questions I thought about during this trip is, what does impact look like in the arts? She's not an artist, but she was able to facilitate art being made and local art being made in a city that perhaps otherwise wouldn't have had that.
I do think, you know, obviously it's not feasible for every profession. You know, like I couldn't just do that. I mean, I guess I could, but not to have the, you know, specific kind of career I want to have, which at this point I really need to be on, you know, one of the coasts to be able to have access to those opportunities. But I think especially potentially in the visual art world, I think that's possible. You know, like I have a sister who's a painter who lives in upstate New York. And in a way, I'm jealous of that. You know, that real artistic community outside of a big city is actually like really appealing to me. Of course, when I sit down and like consciously think about it, of course, I'm aware that there's like wonderful art and communities all over the country. But it's just really cool to hear specifically about one. Yeah. Maybe I'll check it out sometime.
Yeah, you should. And I was thinking about something you said. There are a lot of artists who, especially if they want to have a profession as an actor, they need to be in LA or New York, and that's the economic reality. Do you think that'll ever change?
Yeah, I mean, technology is making it so that it's possible to tape auditions from home, wherever you are. So that's definitely becoming more of a thing. But I can't imagine that soon being able to have a career not living in one of those cities, unless you're already, you know, of a certain level of fame and prominence that you can, you know, live in your country house and just like take calls and meetings occasionally. But then there are places like Atlanta is a really growing, has a really growing TV film scene. Santa Fe, New Mexico. So there are places popping up around the country. I hope that those places continue to offer really good tax incentives for stuff to be filmed there, because it's really good for the local economies and also does diversify and spread out the entertainment scenes, you know, more around the country in a really cool way.
I actually visited, Netflix was opening a studio in Albuquerque. And
oh, I knew that. Yeah.
Yeah. I just hope that they make sure that there's a local economy of artists that can live there. Because one thing that is a hands down truth is when you have a thriving artist community in your city, it actually makes your city better. You know, you have artists and they paint a bunch of murals. Then companies come and they're like, oh my gosh, what a cute little downtown. I guess I'll move my company here. And then a company moves in and people come in and then everyone's just like, oh my gosh, this is so nice, that it completely blows up. So artists are very important. I think that's the formula for economic success. And I will not stand for people treating it as superfluous anymore. That rant is a perfect segue to our next recording, which is with a mayor of the second largest city in Indiana, Fort Wayne. So this is an Indiana mayor. His name is Tom Henry. He has been mayor for, I think, quite a while in Fort Wayne. And we talked a little bit about what it's like being a mayor. He's a Democrat in a pretty conservative district that's very rural outside of the city and voted overwhelmingly for Trump. And he helped sort of dispel some sort of preconceived notions about rural Indiana. And right now we live in a very divided time nationally. Do you ever see the national political division manifesting itself here at home? And if so, how do you combat that to have this unified community that you talk about?
Unquestionably, we have some challenges as a result of decisions that have been being made on the national level. We have a very interesting environment that we live in northern Indiana. Northeastern Indiana is, for the most part, pretty conservative. Some people refer to us as Trump territory. Well, I'm not sure that we're that strong in certain areas, but unquestionably, again, we're a very agriculturally driven area, and many of those who are in the agricultural area are rather conservative in their thinking, and I can understand that. But at the same time, we have the city of Fort Wayne, which I think is a good mixture of those who, I don't know if I want to use the word liberal, but definitely progressive thinkers. And then we have, again, a certain percentage of conservative, but we also have a growing population, and it's primarily the millennials who are bringing to the table a little bit both. I guess you can call it moderate thinking. I think we experienced a lot of that just in this past election. The fact that the House could have as many as 40 new representatives, and all of them Democrat, I think showed a little bit of a swing nationally that perhaps we went a little too far to the right, and now we need to come back.
One thing that I'm really interested in is communities that make a choice to protect a certain culture. Mm-hmm. What do you think it is about Fort Wayne that wants to protect this respect for every citizen? It must be an active thing that everyone has to choose. How do you preserve that?
One of the things that we've been trying to emphasize over the years, at least the 11 years that I've been mayor, is strength and diversity. Our welcome mat is out. And if you want to call for it, well, I don't care where you're from. In fact, we had several calls when our country was struggling with refugees and immigrants. I had several people come to my office, in fact, a rather large group, wanting us to classify ourselves as a sanctuary city. And I did give that some thought. Now, unfortunately, in the state of Indiana, our state prohibits any city from classifying themselves as a sanctuary city. So that by itself caused us to unfortunately not be able to pursue that. That's the kind of community that we have. When that many people came forward and said, Mayor, we've got to be able to let people come to Fort Wayne. If they want to be a contributing person in our community in a positive fashion, then they should be able to. So I think our realizing that we have strength and diversity and that we enjoy different cultures.
So what did you think about what he had to say about attitudes towards immigration during the refugee crisis?
He was so measured. I was really impressed. And I guess that's the thing. I guess you have to be if you are, you know, in a state, even if you're in a blue area, but in a larger red area in a state like Indiana. There was like absolutely nothing even close to vitriol in his tone ever.
Yeah. And I don't think you can have it as a mayor, because I think if you poison the well, it's the well you drink out of. You're not going to leave that community even after you're mayor, after in power. So I really looked to a lot of these mayors for leadership, and it gave me a lot of comfort, because I was doing this during the throes of the government shutdown and all just the crazy Trump things that are happening daily. And it gave me a lot of hope that there are people who are finding ways to bring in a wide coalition of people who may vote for a Democrat as mayor, but also maybe vote differently on a national level.
Well, I'm just honestly still kind of amazed by anyone who splits their vote in this day and age.
Yeah.
Like, it almost sounds like a quaint thing to do, like something of the past. Like, I just feel like we're so polarized. It just always kind of baffles me that people do that. And I've heard of some people doing that kind of as a point of pride. Like, it's almost an ideology in and of itself to do that. And it's really cool, I think, in a way. It reminds me, my half sister and another friend of mine, they live in Poughkeepsie and are both actually painters. My friend was telling me about how the mayor of Poughkeepsie is a Republican and is a really great guy. And not obviously, like, you know, there can't be Republicans who are good people, but, you know, this very progressive artist in Poughkeepsie, he really loves this mayor. I don't know if he voted for him or vote for him again, but I just, every time I hear a story like that, where it seems like someone would split their ticket because of how much like an individual actor, you know, transcends political boundaries, is still always kind of amazing to me.
There was a woman I met in Ohio who is like big, big Trump fan. She's very pugilistic on Facebook. Like, if you don't support the president, unfriend me. I do what I want. America. But she also was pugilistic about this guy that was a Democrat running for mayor of her town. And she was like, you don't come after me. I vote the way I want to. He's a Democrat and he got my light post fixed in 2 days. So like, don't you dare tell me who I should vote for. So, I mean, it's funny. You can kind of think about people and sort of be annoyed. Okay, well, that's not who I support. And I think you're wrong. But also, it's weird when you see her posting stuff about the mayor in the exact same tone. You're kind of like, hell yeah. Like, good for you. It's like what you were saying earlier about, you know, we all have our own narratives. And it's funny how quickly when someone comes into your narrative scope, how quickly you can forgive certain attitudes.
I mean, I like to think that I would vote for a local Republican if I believed in that person over like a really shitty Democrat. But, you know, I'm kind of a sheep too. Like, I like to think that I would, but it would take a whole lot for me to do that. A whole lot. I mean, especially because I always have, you know, Democrats available to me. I'm not living somewhere where, you know, maybe there's like no real, you know, solid Democratic challenger or something, and which that might be another situation.
I think it'd be easier to do it, but I think it'd be harder to tell people.
Mm.
I just feel like there's sort of this culture right now where people don't have enough information about pretty much anything, but everyone has an opinion on everything, even though they might not have information on it. And I think there might be these split ticket voters who do so, but they don't tell anybody, because in so many cultures, if you talk about Democrats in a certain part of the country, it comes with a really charged association. And if you talk about Republicans in certain parts of the country, it has really charged associations because there's so much baggage that comes with it.
I think it's really complicated. I think that, you know, I was just going to say words have meaning, which is the stupidest thing anyone's ever said. But right, we all have our very specific personal associations with language. And then culturally, we do too. And you know, in a similar way to me, it's like, I also think it's kind of, capitalism to me is just as, you know, loaded a term. Mm-hmm. And I think it's interesting that we don't, that capitalism isn't a kind of like triggering word. I don't mean, you know, triggering and like really triggering, but you know, people aren't like really bothered that we just take capitalism as a given. Like, how many people have been completely fucked over by capitalism and like certain capitalistic values? And obviously it's like more complicated than that, but any of these like big idea words that encompass like so much history, I think people are always using these words on different levels and a different level of specificity. And I think that's sometimes where wires get crossed.
Ideological words sometimes talk more about values than they do about logistics. I think for a lot of people, I mean, look how much the Republican Party's changed. Look how much the Democratic Party's changed. And I think when people identify with these things, I think they identify themselves more with specific values. I mean, Republicans 10 years ago wouldn't have dreamed of doing half the things that Trump is doing now, but yet people still identify as Republicans, I think, because of these values. And I really do think it's interesting because when you use socialism and you don't break it down for people, which I actually think Bernie's quite good at doing, he asks the questions, why do other places have this, 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 and this? What Bernie has done is incredible, bringing socialist ideas into the conversation, pointing out that we do live in a socialist government if you are American Airlines or you are Shell Oil, but we live in, I think, what do you say? It's rugged individualism for everyone else.
Except
for right now, obviously, because we're all getting checks from the government because something happened that's not our fault, coronavirus, that put us out of work on a broad scale. So the government's going to come in and help us. But think of all the times that things happen that are not our fault on an individual scale. And the government says, well, that's too bad. I think sort of in conclusion to this diatribe I'm going on, it's nothing's going to be perfect. We can fix problems, but there will still be problems. But what's the balance of how much the government does or doesn't do, and how can we break down the emotional associations with these words, even you know, Republican, Democrat, socialist, because everyone who is a part of those organizations can list 10 great things about being a part of that organization or being part of that ideology. But people that are on the outside can list 10 not so great things. Like Democrats, people say, you know, hypocritical, in the pocket of big money, war hawks. There's tons of things. And socialist people can say, you know, values equality, values justice. But people can also say like limitations on your freedom, high taxes.
Yeah, fundamentally anti-American.
Exactly. I just feel like we're not having an honest conversation about any of it.
I also think it's so hard when like politics is inextricable from culture. I don't know. I haven't read the book by what's his face about political polarization.
Why We're Polarized by Ezra Klein. Is that it?
Yeah. Where he talks about, I think, identity stacking, right? Where like all these different identities get stacked on top of each other and then kind of like fused together. And which is why like we're so triggered by being challenged politically. You know, I was recently talking to a family member who's a Republican and a really smart guy and, you know, quote unquote, socially liberal, whatever that means. And there was no way my mind was going to change about anything, you know, like nothing. Like I could just see down the line and maybe about a specific issue, I would see his side of it. But that one issue was never going to outweigh the whole heap of values live on the Democratic side of it for me. And, you know, and those single issues do matter in something like a primary within your party, where we actually are sometimes having more substantial and, you know, substantive political debates. I think there is some more listening, an ability to really talk about ideas in a clear way and make the case for policy. But between parties, I just don't know how possible that is right now.
Personally, I can't handle things being batshit crazy forever. And I think we're going to move towards, I think because of this coronavirus, honestly,
really?
I'm like evergreen optimistic, but I think everyone that cashes that $1,200 check got government assistance.
God, I hope people recognize that financial assistance people are getting from the government right now, that unemployment, which I've been on unemployment many times in my life as an actor, and also happily pay my taxes because I know that I'm getting something back from the government. But I hope that people make the connection between those policies and the bigger picture. You know, like, it's already people rate Democratic and, you know, socialist leaning policies a lot higher than they rate the Democratic Party. Because I wonder if people just have the sense of, you know, exceptionalism and individualism where they're like, oh, well, this was a crisis, so I needed this. But, you know, normally I don't. But I hope, I mean, that would be amazing if this kind of really opened up people's eyes to, you know, us all being in this together and, yeah, you know, responsible government being really, really important.
I think that's why I'm hopeful that maybe something will come out of this and we'll maybe have a bit of a zeitgeist change. Speaking of corporations and capitalism, I'm going to end this episode with an example of something really cool. There's a town in Indiana called Columbus, Indiana, which is incidentally where Mike Pence is from. This town is really special, and it's something I didn't know about. There's an amazing company called the Cummins Corporation. And what the president of the company did in the 50s is he said, I am going to come out with a list of architects. And if public buildings in this town are built by those architects, I will pay for it. So basically what he created is a mid-century modern town. So the post office is a mid-century modern building, the bridge that comes into the town, mid-century modern, all the churches, all the schools, and it's created this really beautiful town that has art installations every year for budding architects and artists, and it brings people in. And I just thought it was a really cool example of capitalism supporting the arts, which in turn comes around and supports capitalism. I'm not sure if you're seeing the through line of the theme of this podcast, but arts are good for the economy. So let's give a listen to Anne, who runs the annual festival and drove me around Columbus, Indiana.
It's very unique, right? There's no other place that had this sort of architectural patronage program, basically.
It's a unique program, as far as I know. And I think that other cities have, you know, wonderful architecture, but this is such a small city, and it's really very well preserved. A lot of the buildings are still used with their original purpose, and then those that are not still used for their original purpose have been preserved and sort of used for other things, but maintaining the integrity of the architecture. And so I think that's really special. The Cummins Corporation has purchased some of the buildings and uses them for other things. You'll see the Aerosarin and Bank at the corner here, which is one of the first modern glass banks in America, commissioned by the Millers for their banking enterprise. And this one is by Aerosarin. And so it's really that modernist idea of transparency in banking, which we'll see later at the former newspaper building. So it was the same idea of being able to see journalism happening and having no barriers between the two. And so this is now being used as a conference center for Cummins. And so we're sort of at the heart of their corporate campus here.
Yeah, Maddie, what did you have to think about Columbus, Indiana, and my friend Anne?
I mean, what's neat and specific about this example, too, right, is that the industry capitalism was supporting the art, was bringing the art in the first place, right? I think so often their art exists somewhere, you know, at a ground level, and then it becomes an appealing place, and, you know, corporations come in and gentrify. Mm-hmm. So take advantage of the current art and exploit it a bit without, you know, supporting it or its makers. And what's so cool about this is that it's actually the other way around, which is really refreshing. And is kind of, I guess, what other countries have in the form of like government subsidized art and theater and stuff. She's making a good point, but also you're making a really good point about industry and art working hand in hand and supporting each other in this symbiotic way.
Totally. And, you know, everyone talks about Rust Belt towns where manufacturing goes away and there are no more jobs. It doesn't sound like it's happened to Columbus, Indiana, which is a really cool thing. And I hope, you know, mayors across the country can consider arts, because here in Kansas City, our mayor cut the arts budget pretty significantly this year. And I'm not going to take that line down. So it's also very close. Columbus, Indiana is very close to Louisville, which has the Actors Theater, which will be featured on a future episode. So look forward to that. And one last thing to tie it back. When I was talking to Joanna, I didn't put this in the recording, but she talked about what she realized was her responsibility as a gentrifier in the community. Mm-hmm. And she went around to different businesses and said, all right, if you want to open up a business here, you need to pay all of your workers a living wage. You mm-hmm. need to hire local workers. You need to devote this much time to neighborhood events. The pre-enactments, you have a responsibility now to be a part of this neighborhood.
Wow.
I think the neighborhood is one of the best canvases to make change. We're talking about ideals. There are ways to apply ideals to your neighborhood, and there are actually ways to make change. And I think that sort of idea of grassroots change, which this trip was sort of all about, looking for examples mm-hmm. of people making small little changes in the United States, I think that's what gives me hope that things will get a little better.
Yeah. Hopefully. I think it can feel really hopeless sometimes to make any kind of difference.
Mm-hmm.
Unless the local government is like really behind you, and that can even feel so overwhelming, and like how to get involved.
Totally. And I think we forget both business and government at a local level are things that we control.
Yeah.
We vote people in, we vote people out, we keep stores in business. And I think we've kind of come to a place where we feel like the government rules us and corporations rule us too. And I just think remembering that, you know, at least from a local level, we can remind people that they're there to serve us, literally, if you're a restaurant, and figuratively if you're a government, I guess.
Yeah. And that does, you know, happen on individual levels. Like there was a restaurant that opened up in Crown Heights near me where I used to live. That was opened up by, I think it was a white woman. And it was like so more than offensive. It was like Crown Heights tourism. They put like fake bullet holes in the wall, I think.
Oh,
and we're serving our their cocktail. I mean, like next level, like so bafflingly beyond tone deaf and offensive. And there were boycotts and signs all over. And it was a really good example of the community dictating what kind of behavior was or was not okay. But it felt like a specific example of the community using their collective power, and something that I think otherwise can be really hard to harness.
This has all been so great. Like, I've loved talking to you. Is there anything else you want to talk about regarding New York, Bruised Fruit, The Bachelor?
Oh, God. I mean, I could talk about The Bachelor. I could talk about Survivor forever.
I've never seen it.
But, Ryan, I think you'd love it.
Okay.
I still have 24 seasons to go through.
And maybe the quarantine will be over by then.
Oh, God. Yeah. Well, I don't know when this episode will come out. I hope when it does, we're in a better place, everyone in the world, and hopefully everyone's safe. Yeah, I think that's it. Thank you for chatting, Ryan. I love your podcast, and it was really nice to have this excuse to catch up.
Thanks for listening. If you have the time, please leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. And if you want to engage with us on social media, we are 50 States of Mind on Facebook and Instagram, and 50 States Pod on Twitter. Special thanks to Bright Moments for the theme music, and our entire team for putting in so much hard work. See you next time.